Hi, listeners. Welcome to the ACG Case Reports Journal podcast. I'm Khushbu Gala. I'm the co-editor-in-chief of ACG Case Reports. It is my pleasure to host the 12th and final podcast of this academic year. Today, we will discuss a case of concomitant achalasia and Barrett's esophagus. I am pleased to welcome with us Dr. Sally Samo, who is the senior author of this paper. Dr. Samo is an assistant professor of medicine at the Kansas University School of Medicine. He earned his medical degree from the University of Aleppo, completed his residency at present St. Francis Hospital, and GI fellowship at Emory University. We also have with us Dr. Chamil Kodapilli, the content expert for today's cases. Dr. Kodapilli is an assistant professor at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He earned his medical degree from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, completed his residency, GI fellowship, and advanced fellowship in esophageal diseases at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you. Yeah. It's great to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Likewise. Thank you, Dr. Gala.
Awesome. I will start our conversation today with Dr. Kodapilli. Dr. Kodapilli, could you please define Barrett's esophagus and achalasia for our audience?
Sure. So I guess the most experience that I would have would be what we consider Barrett's esophagus here in the West in the United States. So for Barrett's esophagus, what essentially happens here is that the inner lining of your esophagus, that squamous mucosa, is replaced by intestinal mucosa, intestinal metaplasia. And it theoretically, you need both endoscopic and histologic findings in order to confirm this diagnosis. So within the tubular esophagus, you have to have at least 1 centimeter of that salmon-colored mucosa extending into the tubular esophagus. And that can be very tricky, especially for new fellows that are just learning endoscopy, because where do the gastric folds end, which is what we typically use in the West as the marker differentiator between the esophagus and the stomach. So it's very careful. It's important to be very careful to really insufflate, deflate the esophagus to get a good sense of where those gastric folds end and where the esophagus begins. And again, that salmon-colored mucosa has to then extend at least 1 centimeter above the GE junction, the top of those gastric folds. I believe mostly in the East, they tend to use the findings of the palisade vessels as that differentiator. That's something we don't typically do in the West, but that would be kind of the main difference. And then histologically, there would be evidence of intestinal metaplasia. The characteristic of that would be the goblet cells, which you would see under the microscope. So that's essentially the basic diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus. Achalasia is essentially you have a loss of the myenteric plexus neurons in the esophagus. So what ends up happening is you lose some of the functions of the esophagus. So you lose the ability of the esophagus to pump or to have peristalsis. At the same time, the lower esophageal sphincter doesn't relax. So patients swallow, they just can't transit food normally through their esophagus, and they have pretty typical symptoms of dysphagia, regurgitation, and sometimes chest pain.
That was a great start. And I think we've set the stage for Dr. Samo. Dr. Samo, could you please walk us through this really interesting case of concomitant achalasia and Barrett's esophagus?
Of course. So our patient in this case is a 73-year-old gentleman who was referred to our clinic for achalasia. His predominant symptoms were dysphagia, regurgitation, and thick mucus of foam at his throat. While he told us he has a diagnosis of achalasia made based on endoscopy only, 8 years ago, prior to his presentation, he also told us he had a diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus made 10 years ago, so a couple of years before he was diagnosed with achalasia. His achalasia was being managed with periodic lower esophageal sphincter botulinum toxin injection that would lead to an improvement lasting 6 to 12 months each time. 6 months prior to his presentation to us, he had an upper endoscopy that showed 4 centimeter Barrett's esophagus, and he also underwent endoscopic balloon dilation. And at the same time, he also again had lower esophageal sphincter botulinum toxin injection. On our evaluation, we asked him to fill for us his Ecker score. And his Ecker score was 7 out of 12, with 12 being the worst score, and 0 means patient is asymptomatic. His endoscopy showed a dilated esophageal lumen with stasis changes and excessive amount of foam in his esophagus. His distal esophagus appeared tight, didn't open well on in insufflation. He also had a 4-centimeter salmon-colored mucosa, good as C0M4 per the Prague class, meaning the maximum extent of the salmon-colored mucosa is 4 centimeter, but there is no circumferential length of that area. His biopsy confirmed intestinal metaplasia, and he was also found to have 2-centimeter hiatal hernia. We also did EndoFLIP function lumen imaging probe, which showed decreased distensibility of esophagogastric junction, and his esophageal manometry showed type 2 achalasia. Because of the findings of achalasia and hiatal hernia and Barrett's, we sent him for Hiller myotomy and also to fix his hiatal hernia. And he also had a door wrap with it to hopefully decrease the amount of GERD that could happen afterward. About 4.5 months evaluation later, he was doing well and his Eckard score was 0 out of 12.
Awesome. And for our listeners, Dr. Samo, could you just please clarify what a door fundoplication is?
So there are a few types of fundoplications. The most common one that you might hear about is called the Nissen fundoplication, which is a complete 360-degree posterior wrap. And then you have some modified partial fundoplications. One of them you might hear about is toupee, which is a modified 270-degree posterior wrap. A door is a modified 180-degree anterior wrap.
Got it. And so thanks for walking us through this very interesting case. Dr. Kodapilli, could you elaborate more on the pathophysiology of Barrett's and achalasia and explain to our listeners why they are fundamentally opposing processes?
Of course. So this is a great question. I think from a learning perspective, when we think about Barrett's esophagus, the underlying issue that we think is going on is just persistent or continuous acid reflux. So when there's persistent esophageal acid injury, the changes, the metaplastic changes of Barrett's esophagus take place. And the way I kind of simplify this for my patients that have Barrett's is I tell them, hey, you know, your esophagus is suddenly dealing with all this acid, but your body's pretty smart. So it's trying to figure out how can we deal with this acid? And so it changes. So it becomes more like the stomach, because we know the stomach has a lot of mucus secreting cells that helps to protect itself from the acid. So that's kind of like what the esophagus does to protect itself from gastroesophageal reflux. So that's kind of how I tell my patients that. I think that helps put that into perspective. The concern, though, is those metaplastic changes can drive other genetic changes that can lead to neoplastic transformation. So that's why we worry about Barrett's esophagus, and in appropriate settings, we would do surveillance and or endoscopic therapies if there's evidence of dysplasia. In achalasia, the issue here is that we're losing the function of the myenteric plexus neurons that control the motility of the esophagus. So we lose the ability of the esophagus to peristalse, so food can't be pumped down into the stomach, and the lower esophageal sphincter doesn't relax. So there's essentially a functional obstruction for food leaving the esophagus going into the stomach.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so Dr. Samo, do you have any potential explanations for why your patient may have had coexisting disease?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a great question. And, you know, this is based on a hypothesis. You cannot confirm this because this happened so many years ago. But the leading theory here is that the patient has had chronic reflux that was complicated by development of Barrett's esophagus. And later on, he developed primary idiopathic achalasia. The reason I think that is because GERD and achalasia are, you know, as we just alluded to, are opposing pathophysiology. So while we know in achalasia patients who undergo myotomy, reflux is common, which could lead to development of Barrett's esophagus, naive achalasia, or those patients with achalasia without having myotomy, it's very unlikely to have a significant GERD that could lead to development of Barrett's esophagus.
So if I'm understanding correctly, you think that if someone is predisposed to getting this at an earlier age, you could potentially have time to develop the Barrett's esophagus before developing achalasia?
Absolutely. And you know, I see young people in their 20s and some in their teenage years that they have Barrett's esophagus. So this could really occur at an early stage of life.
That's very interesting. I know that you know, the landscape of GERD and, like you said, Barrett's esophagus is changing, probably a mix of, you know, increasing obesity and other risk factors. So, Dr. Kodapilli, could you perhaps talk to our listeners about some nuances if you were managing a similar case?
Yeah, so I think Dr. Samo hit it right in the head here. In essence, this patient has two diseases that are diametrically opposite of each other. One is really due to reflux. And in somebody who has achalasia, you really can't get reflux. You kind of have the perfect anti-reflux anatomy. I think the important thing to highlight in this case, though, as Dr. Samo's team did, is I think it was really smart for them to do a fundoplication post-myotomy. When we think about how to manage achalasia, the other kind of defining a treatment therapy that we have would be POEM, peroral endoscopic myotomy. But typically, there's no anti-reflux procedure done in that setting. And we know from the literature that up to 70% of patients can have post-POEM reflux. So I think it was really smart of the team to go ahead with a fundoplication because a POEM may have exacerbated their Barrett's esophagus and could have caused more issues down the road. So I think that's a very important learning point here.
Yeah, maybe we don't have that long of an experience with POEM yet, but Dr. Kodapilli, do you think that it's possible, especially for someone who develops achalasia at a young age, to theoretically even develop Barrett's after a POEM procedure?
I think at a young age, certainly, because if we do a POEM on a young achalasia patient, they potentially could have decades of reflux ahead of them. And if that's poorly controlled, I do think that there is a possibility of Barrett's esophagus, but also other reflux-related issues such as peptic strictures. So certainly, I think that's a definite possibility.
Well, that was a fantastic discussion. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed and learned as much as I did. On behalf of the ACG Case Reports Journal Board, I would like to thank both of you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us. Thank you very much. I hope everybody learned something.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Gall. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your podcast.